From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
We just have to drill down and just answer the question of what happened.
We need to offer these families closure. When is someone going to own this? I keep hearing dodges. I keep hearing explanations. I don't hear ownership.
Ultimately, I'm responsible for our veterans' homes and our veterans' well-being.
That's the former State Department of Veterans Affairs Secretary Linda Chapalavia. She was speaking back in December. We also heard several lawmakers during a hearing into a deadly COVID outbreak at the LaSalle Veterans Home, and lawmakers wanted to know what happened. Now a report is out that provides some details, and we'll be talking about that. Also, the governor has offered up his own energy proposal. We'll break down what it would do. That and more coming up on State Week. I'm Sean Crawford in Springfield, and our panel includes Charlie Wheeler, Emeritus Professor and former Director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. Charlie is also a longtime State House reporter and observer. Also with us, we have Hannah Meisel, NPR Illinois State House editor, and joining us today, Steve Daniels with Crane Chicago Business. And Steve, thanks for being with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Hannah, I'm going to go to you first, though. This morning, Friday morning, as we sat down to record this show, a report was released that examines that COVID outbreak that occurred last year at the LaSalle Veterans Home. And recap for us what this report found.
Well, it was truly a stunning read. It's about 50 pages, and, you know, page after page is just another thing that makes you go, how is this not addressed? You know, not just before COVID, but years ago. It blames an organizational structure that was unworkable and left people with very different responsibilities, communications failures, not just in the LaSalle Veterans Home where the outbreak, you know, that killed those 36 veterans occurred, but also at the Department of Veterans Affairs, which oversees that home and three others. And everything from not being trained on proper COVID protocols and PPE, even though it was 8 months into the pandemic at this point in early November when the outbreak began in the home. And, you know, I think one of the most just crazy things to me was that the Department of Veterans Affairs director, Linda Chapalavia, listeners might remember she was a 16-year member, Democratic member of the Illinois House. She basically, it says in the report, she abdicated her responsibilities to her chief of staff. Now, agency directors in the past, you know, they're not involved in day-to-day, micromanagement. They're supposed to be overseeing a bigger picture. But in this case, she wasn't doing any of those things. She literally just left it up to her chief of staff, who was doing three jobs. And, you know, it's no wonder that things fell off his plate, things fell off the wagon, and just top to bottom, just failure after failure of communication and responsibility. It's crazy to read.
Hannah, this, when I think back to this outbreak, I remember us talking about it at the time, the reporting on it. Things that stood out at the time were things like hand sanitizer being purchased that was ineffective. It was the wrong hand sanitizer to be using. Employees not wearing masks. You would think that would have been an easy requirement to make. Is there any, there has been fallout already from what happened there. People have lost their jobs. There, I think, have been other changes. Is there anything else coming that we know of, or do we expect there's going to be something else coming from this?
Well, I mean, yeah, there's that, the immediate follow that you mentioned, that folks lost their jobs. The administrator of that home was fired. Linda Chapalavia left her job in January. And the chief of staff that I mentioned, he has already submitted his resignation. But, you know, broader fallout, Republicans are going to hammer the governor, every week until, you know, the election, which is, you know, around the corner, really. So there's that political fallout. And there's also, in in the what the governor released along with the report this morning, there was support of this bill that would create an accountability kind of mechanism for the Department of Veterans Affairs. But originally, that bill that is sponsored by State Representative Stephanie Kifewit, who is a veteran herself and is in charge of the House Veterans Affairs Committee, it originally called for an inspector general in that agency. But critics say that that was watered down. And so we'll see if, you know, they can pressure her to beef that back up. But with the governor's office seeming to have requested something a little bit, you know, with a little bit less teeth, this accountability kind of mechanism, we'll see. But yes, I mean, fallout is yet to be had. It's still, you know, just a few hours, several hours after that report was released when we're taping here on Friday morning. There's going to be a lot more.
You know, Charlie, I don't want to make excuses, but I have heard from people who worked in nursing homes during this pandemic, and they have said, you know, we're really just not trained for this. We were never prepared for dealing with a pandemic. And it sounds kind of similar here at the veterans home. So it seems like, I think Hannah touched on this, it almost is like systemic failure that's going on here. Your thoughts on what you've seen so far?
Well, I would say this is a very damning report. And what struck me is, I guess for want of a better term, the sort of lackadaisical approach by Chapelavie and some of the higher ups in the department. The report noted, you mentioned the hand sanitizer. Well, the report noted that the sanitizer issue was, quote, emblematic of larger communication and organizational failures. We shut down the state, or the governor shut down the state in March, right? Because this was a pandemic. It was something a lot different. It wasn't like seasonal flu. And so, as the report noted, the department had from March all the way up until the fall, all the way, because the first cases didn't pop up until November at LaSalle. They had all that time to prepare, to put out an emergency plan. How are we going to handle this when it occurs here in our nursing home, as it is bound to do? Because we have people coming in and out all the time. We take the vets to the hospital. LaSalle County's rates are going up. And it was like the leadership just took a walk on it. And to me, that's the most damning thing. And the report goes out of its way to compliment the, what would you say, the little people on the ground actually doing the hard work, who are trying to do their best without any guidance from their supposedly managing superiors. And I think it's interesting because Chapelavie, as Hannah said, was basically a political appointee. She didn't have, I would venture to say, much experience at all in running a nursing home. Now, the person that Pritzker appointed a couple weeks ago, Terry Prince, is a 31-year veteran U.S. Navy. He was superintendent of the Veterans Home in Ohio. And so he's got a lot more experience, and he's already come in and he's made a lot of changes. After the debacle with the Legionnaires' disease in Quincy, there was a report made and recommended, I don't know, like two dozen different things that should be done. Basically, none of those changes were made. And this report came, oh gosh, maybe 2 years ago. And so Prince is, I think, a good choice, and he seems to be very committed to getting this stuff done. So I hope we've seen the worst of it. But as I say, in my mind, it was just mind-boggling that the folks kind of sat on their hands and pretended, oh, nothing to see here, while all around them in LaSalle County, the infection rate was going up, hospitalizations were going up, intensive care was going up. And it was like, oh, we're here in our veterans home, and none of that stuff that's happening in the outside world is going to affect us.
You're listening to State Week. I'm Sean Crawford, along with Charlie Wheeler, Hannah Meisel, and Steve Daniels with Crane Chicago Business. And we're going to move on. We will talk more about this issue and I'm sure the aftermath coming up in future weeks. But Steve, we have you here because you certainly follow the utility industry. And Governor J.B. Pritzker this week unveiled his own package when it comes to energy. What does it look like? What does it entail?
Well, it is quite a large package, maybe the largest ever proposed in Illinois in terms of energy. And we've seen some big ones in the past. The ambitions, the goal that he has set forth and that all of the various parties have attempted to achieve in much different ways is to put the state on a course to have a power generation industry that is 100% carbon free by 2050 and to make a lot of progress on that within the next 10-15 years. So I think most people would applaud that and say that that's a good thing, that our climate issues are close to an emergency kind of a situation and that we need to do something. But in the energy sector, it is always a matter of who gets paid, who doesn't get paid, and the money always seems to come from the same place, which is you, me, and everybody else in the state, ratepayers, finance, these sorts of ambitions. So the governor's bill attempts to do this by preserving two nuclear plants. They're carbon-free emitters, so they're important and they're very substantial power generation sources in the state, by subsidizing them. They're owned by Exelon, and Exelon has threatened to close them in the fall. Exelon has come back and said what's in the bill is woefully inadequate, and they will need quite a bit more in order to do that. That will be a subject of negotiation, certainly. In addition, the governor wants to double the charges that ratepayers pay in order to grow a renewable solar and wind projects in the state, finance more of them. The money comes through the Illinois Power Agency, which buys power on behalf of utility customers of ComEd and Ameren. And so that's another substantial part of this. The other big issue that the governor attempted to address was the scandal with Commonwealth Edison and its admitted bribery scheme, trying to influence Speaker Madigan over the last 10 years or so to pass through broad energy bills that were very lucrative for ComEd and for other utilities. So the governor's got a number of provisions that would seek to clamp down on ComEd. Most noteworthy is an end to the formula rate making scheme that enables ComEd to change its rates annually with a relatively truncated regulatory process that essentially allows ComEd more or less to set its own rates. That has proved very controversial, and ComEd's got extremely ambitious plans to spend a lot more money on capital investments, which is what leads to higher delivery rates. And so the governor is attempting to clamp down on that. There's plenty more, a whole section on jumpstarting the electric vehicle business in the state. The other big headline is a phase out of coal-fired power plants by 2030. And a phase out of natural gas fired power plants by 2045. So there's an awful lot in here. A lot of these various sections could easily be bills on their own. So to do all of this in one go with 30 days left is going to be quite something.
Yeah, that's something I was wondering. With only about a month of the session left, like you said, a lot to get done. Does this get put... Is it possible maybe some of these things could pass, that maybe this package could be divvied up in some way, or do you think it may topple under its own weight in this short period of time?
Yeah, that's exactly the phrase I was going to use. I think this is one of those classic ones that easily could die of its own weight. There is a lot of desire in Springfield to do something about climate. And the governor, there's a huge desire on his part to get something big done here as well. The political backdrop to all of this is that You know, this hasn't been an easy 6 to 9 months for the governor. You know, COVID, there's COVID, obviously, but then there's also the defeat of his graduated income tax. The voters voted that down last year. He doesn't appear to be sort of leading things in a number of ways. That we mentioned the Black Caucus bills at the outset here. Those were not things that he led on. He's had to respond to those things, and he's by and large, well, he has. He signed all of them, even though some of them have caused great consternation in the business community and elsewhere. So at any rate, I think this is a prime candidate, this energy bill is a prime candidate for him to show that he can lead on something big and ambitious as he goes to the voters for a second term.
Yeah, this is a very significant piece of legislation. But I think the question of whether it can get done, you have to consider that none of these ideas are brand new. They've been bouncing around for some time. There was a clean energy bill that was moving last session before the pandemic, and they didn't have time to finish it off because the legislature basically shut down and there wasn't time in the lame duck session. So the ideas are out there. They've been debated. There's a union-backed plan, and the union, supporters of the union plan criticized the governor because he doesn't have strong enough labor protections in there. One of the things that's in the governor's plan is a price of $8 per ton on carbon emissions for fossil fuel plants, which is an idea that the business community, some people have suggested, is a way to encourage the market to move away from coal, which I think it's doing anyway. And so I would not be surprised if some kind of a compromise emerges. It will certainly will have the ethics components, because unlike, say, 4 or 5 years ago, when the ComEd pretty much could call the shots, it is operating from a very crippled position because of the fact that it admitted, yes, we tried very, very hard to basically bribe our way to get a couple of pieces of legislation in the past. And as you said earlier, this is probably the most major effort to do something about the energy field in Illinois since we deregulated electricity, what, maybe 20 years ago.
Yeah, Steve, is there an actual, or do you feel as though there's some momentum to, I don't want to use, I guess I will use the term punish Commonwealth Edison, or some lawmakers want to see them reined into such a level that that could sink this type of package?
I think that Exelon is a, and obviously Exelon owns ComEd, so the two are tied together. But the nuclear plants, I think, are the going to be the issue that has to be addressed now, because they will close. I think Exelon has shown in the past that it's not crying wolf when it makes these threats and starts going down this path. They will close without action in this session. So I think there's a possibility that we see something smaller that deals with that, that also deals with restarting a stalled renewable energy industry in the state, and also gets into potentially the ethics questions on ComEd. But to your question specifically, I think ComEd, there's a dance going on here, and ComEd understands that they can't be seen as, you know, leading the charge on anything in this. The unions have picked up for ComEd and Exelon in that regard and are seeking to fill that vacuum. We have seen lawmakers, and the union bill in particular, has, while it says that it does, it ends formula rates, has, keeps components of it for ComEd, and I do think that there's a real risk that yes, there is a headline ending formula rates, but that we see favorable rate treatment that enables ComEd to spend at levels we've never seen in terms of And that's how, again, rates go up is spending, and they recover it at a profit with not enough scrutiny as to what's the larger plan here? What are we seeking to accomplish? And, you know, you like any business or any household, you have to make choices on what you can buy and what you have to put off. And at least in terms of utility spending of late in this state, we have not seen utilities forced to make those kinds of choices.
Well, it was a busy week for the governor because also he had to answer a lot of questions this week when it came to what some are calling a flip-flop on a campaign promise when it comes to redistricting. And Hannah, fill us in on what's the controversy there.
After the census data came out on Monday, showing that Illinois had, you know, lost a congressional seat yet again, and also for the first time in our 200-year history, lost population. The governor, when he was running in 2018, he was asked, you know, will you pledge to veto any legislative maps that are drawn by lawmakers or political folks and their staffs and, you know, any sort of qualifier like that? And he said yes. He wanted an independent commission. He wanted that either the state would amend its constitution to allow for that, which has been tried a couple times but blocked by the courts, or in the absence of that, he said, well, we should just hand it off to an independent commission anyway, and then the lawmakers can sign off on basically whatever they say they want. So it was kind of stunning on Monday to watch the governor stumble around this question, because he really should have been prepared. He's been asked a version of this question before, but I think the wording on the question was particularly good this time around. And it was almost like watching someone like try to back away from a spotlight on stage, but instead falling off the stage because it was just so bad. Because he could have said something like, well, because the you know, some Democrats are saying now, you know, yes, we in the past might have supported the concept, but really it's unconstitutional. So all he had to say in my mind was, oh, well, I've spoken to legal counsel and it turns out that's unconstitutional. So we have the process we have. And because, of course, what's unsaid a lot from Democrats is that they don't want to do anything to risk losing their partisan advantage. If maps aren't passed, or if the governor doesn't sign new maps by June 30th, the process gets handed off to an appointed panel as prescribed by the Constitution. And if that panel can't agree, which it has not in the past when it's been used, except for one time, taking a name out of a stovepipe hat, which is literally what happens, you know, could determine that Republicans get partisan control over the maps. And that would be a very tough pill to swallow for Democrats who have been in the supermajority for years and don't want to give that up.
Yeah, Charlie, this sounds like it's heading to exactly what you had said a week or two ago regarding the governor being willing to sign a map and will make his own rationale for doing that.
The Constitution is pretty firm in saying that, as Hannah said, we go to this very partisan procedure if the legislature and the governor don't have maps signed. Now, this is for the General Assembly. The congressional maps, there is no such time limit on. But the governor said he will veto an unfair map. So what's an unfair map? Well, I think I saw a quote somewhere from one Republican lawmaker. A fair map is a map that will elect more Republicans. And I'm thinking, yeah, that's kind of the bottom line. It's always been the bottom line. When the Democrats draw the maps, they want to elect Democrats. When the Republicans drew the maps for the 90s election cycle, they wanted to elect Republicans. That's part of the game. And this notion that, well, we don't want people to be left out. We don't want politicians to pick their voters. We want the voters to pick the politicians. The fact of the matter is, if you are a liberal and you live in Effingham County, you are going to be left out no matter how, whatever kind of maps are drawn. Or conversely, if you're a conservative and you live in the Lincoln Park area, you're not going to have a representative in the General Assembly who shares your sentiments and your policy positions. Again, to date myself, if we really were interested in making sure that varying viewpoints were represented throughout the state, we'd go back to an idea from 1870 and we'd go back to cumulative voting, where you would have multi-member districts and there would be an opportunity for the minority party to have representation in every part of the state.
This is coming, there's a national backdrop here. The US Supreme Court has ruled that there's essentially no role for courts in redistricting. So Illinois, being the state that it is, had, you know, the governor's got to look at other states all over the country and whether they're red or blue, and virtually none of them are taking steps to make this fairer. And they're all taking steps to help whatever party is in control there.
Okay. Time now for our notes from the field. Hannah, let's start with you.
Well, I was going to go with something else, but breaking news in the last couple minutes, I guess. Congresswoman Sherry Bustos from, northwest part of Illinois, she has announced that she is not going to seek another term in Congress. And a connection to Springfield, Sherry Bustos was a graduate of the Public Affairs Reporting Program, the same one that Charlie led for many years, and was a reporter before she went into politics.
All right. And Charlie?
Well, there was a history made of sorts in Illinois this week when our bill backlog was reduced from an all-time high of $16.7 billion in 2017 to less than $4 billion this week. And as a matter of fact, as we're taping the show this morning, it was $3.3 billion and only 9,000 outstanding vouchers.
And Steve?
Yeah, well, among a number of very significant political developments in the city of Chicago was the indictment this just yesterday of Alderman Patrick Daley Thompson, Bridgeport 11th Ward Alderman, and obviously member of the famous family, on charges related to the failure of a low-profile bank in Bridgeport, Washington Federal Savings, that he had borrowed money from. That bank, federal prosecutors say, basically handed out loans to various connected people with no need or requirement for those people to pay them back. And among those people, according to these indictments, was the alderman who took loans out, hundreds of thousands of dollars, and didn't pay them back for several years until after the bank had failed. He is fighting the charges, says any issues were inadvertent, and that and that he is innocent. So, but the bigger deal here, obviously, is that this is the first member of the Daley family to be indicted for something like this. I mean, these loans took place before he was in office, but this is the grandson of Mayor Richard J. and the nephew of Mayor Richard M. And to this point, there's a lot of Daleys. We've never seen one indicted for something like this.
And that's all the time we have for this episode of State Week. Our panel included Charlie Wheeler, Hannah Meisel, and Steve Daniels with Crane Chicago Business. Get a podcast of our show at nprillinois.org or through the NPR One app. And join us next time. I'm Sean Crawford.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capitol by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.